There you go. Buffalo Springfield from a, that was actually from a live TV feed. I couldn't even tell if it was, it's not bandstand, but something. And that's got to be an early, that's an early, early cut of it too. Going to continue on, and Tyler Hoffman is going to join us. And Tyler, you know, one of the young guns. And of course, you know, you think back to 2019 and Scott Coles and Matt Valvoggi, and Tyler, I think, is probably the next. He's the next wave, and he's gunning to, you know, to be the youngest NHC champion ever. It's a pleasure to have Tyler Hoffman join us. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on. That was a very warm introduction.
You know, the times that I've looked in recent memory at, you know, almost every one of the Santa Anita contests, you know, whether it's a, you know, a big day challenge or, you know, just a Saturday get together, your name is invariably etched somewhere on the upper half of the leaderboard, and very frequently right at the top. Of course, everybody, you know, is having to make adjustments to play online for now, and you made the most of it with a seat that you knocked out. I mean, talk a little bit about how you've adjusted to, you know, and how much you obviously miss the on-site action at Santa Anita.
Oh, there's no question. The hardest part of everything going on in the world right now is not being able to actually be at Santa Anita and not only just participate in those live money contests, but, you know, to actually be out there, be in the paddock, sitting on the bench that so many people have told me. My dad and I kind of have taken over in the paddock and, you know, watching live racing and the camaraderie of the Eddie Logan suite and things like that. It's something that I miss a ton, and obviously can't wait to be back out there. Hopefully it'll be safe enough for us to return to Santa Anita when they reopen in the fall. I know everyone's hopeful
exactly.
for that. In terms of
and Del Mar, too.
Play, oh, Del Mar, too, but that looks a little bit more like a long shot from just the stuff that I've been reading about.
Yeah.
They didn't even really offer box seat renewals, which is kind of a telling story of what they think is going to happen over that, you know, 8-week meet or so. In terms of your question, going back to tournament play, yeah, it's been a lot of fun playing tournaments over the years, and obviously being one of the younger guys, I don't have the biggest bankroll or anything like that, but I play a lot with my father, Alan Hoffman, and he and I have teamed up for many, many years, and let's just say I've been playing contests since maybe a little bit before I was of age to play and participate in them in my own name, but we've had a lot of success with them over the years, and we actually won a tournament for about $30,000 back in the fall of 2018. We've been in the top five several times. We've participated in the Breeders' Cup Challenge. We actually finished seventh back in 2012, 2013. So those type of live money tournaments, they don't roll around a lot, but when they do, you got to make them count. And we've been fortunate enough to make them count a lot. I was lucky enough to qualify for the fourth year in a row now on an NHC qualifier a couple weeks ago. And just like anything else, when you're playing these online tournaments, what makes them so much tougher than playing the actual live money contest is the fact that you have so many more people playing for such limited spots. I mean, there were 452 people in this online tournament, and you had to be top three. And I didn't even finish in the top three. Ironically, I finished fifth, but the red-hot Steve Arison on the tour right now got both his entries to finish second and fourth, and so the last qualifying spot fell to me. So it was one of those things that was more lucky than anything else. But as we all know in this game, luck's half of it.
No doubt. And you talk a little bit about, you know, your evolution and how you even came to the contest side of things. I know from Twitter, just looking at the, you know, at your Twitter page, at the homepage, go back to 2010, so 10 years ago, Showviver, which is, you know, people think that those kinds of games are, you know, are just kind of fun and, you know, they've got some small prizes. But it obviously, given how old you are, it must have been a, you know, a very nice entree into, you know, looking daily at cards and, you know, getting a strategy concept and, you know, just a good way to wade into the environment.
Yeah, the Survivor Tournament is probably what I'm best known for because I was 18 years old when I won that. And a lot of people that are probably listening to this right now know the story. And it was always a competition between my father and I. It had nothing to do with trying to win the tournament. There was no expectations for it. I was just trying to beat him head-to-head. We always goofed around with that tournament, just trying to pick a show horse once a day. And it was one of those things where kind of got lucky, won a couple photos, you know, survived an inquiry. He got knocked out early, and before we knew it, there was, you know, 17 people left, and I still remember he called me. At that point, I was a freshman in college at the University of Washington, and he called me, and he goes, "Hey, only 17 people left. You might as well win it at this point. I mean, what's the point of going this far and not winning it?" I said, "Okay." So we did, and I think I got like $3,000 for it, but the money was great, obviously, being 18 years old and winning $3,000, that doesn't happen every weekend when you're betting, you know, $2 and $4. But what I liked most about that experience was the people that it allowed me to be introduced to as a result of it. And a lot of them have become very close friends of mine. It's kind of opened up a whole new world in Santa Anita for me, specifically related to getting to meet, you know, somebody like a Tom Quigley and Nate Newby and things like that. And just kind of an introduction to serious contest players. A lot of them, you know, playing in the Eddie Logan Suite, the Leo Monoviches and the Ryan Flanders.
Hmm.
The Chris Poderats, you know, people like that you get to come across and interact with, and it's a lot of fun. You get to pick their brains on, you know, kind of what they're looking at. And obviously growing up, my father and my uncle, Edwin Sponhurst, they played tournaments since probably the late 2000s, even earlier than that. I think there used to be a tournament back in Reno that they participated in. And so I kind of followed them and watched them play those and participate and, you know, rooted along for them and wanted their success. And just, you know, started to take little tidbits and incorporate it into my own handicapping and kind of go from there. And it just kind of grew. It was as simple as that. I love the aspect that contests allow you to play because it's a little bit different way of attacking a card. You don't have to be right, you know, trying to string together a pick four or pick five for a big score. You really just have to crush one race. You crush one race, you're in the tournament. You crush a second race, now you're winning the tournament. And it's really as simple as that, and that's all you're trying to do.
You know, that's interesting because when we talk to horsemen, you talk to riders, every horse, you know, almost any horse will give you one run. And, you know, a good horse will give you two runs. And then, you know, a great horse might respond three times, you know, when asked. And it there's a real parallel there. I mean, to sort of be involved and then, you know, to be in real contention and win. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion of late, actually, you know, just about, you know, the formatting. I brought this up with Pete Fornatale last week or 2 weeks ago about, you know, the prospects when, you know, we get to the end of a contest and, you know, if it's live action and, you know, people start swinging for the fences, and if you get a couple of prices, I mean, just look at last week at Gulfstream. You had those 250-to-1 shots. You had two cap horses essentially back to back, and it sort of takes, you know, some of the fun out of it. And it's one of the reasons it seems that a lot of people are saying, you know, the pick and pray is so much more equitable in that regard, that, you know, people have to both handicap and have their game theory strategy decided, and there can't be any playing the board at the 11th hour.
No, absolutely, and I think what most of us refer to is the pick and pray format eliminates the stabbing that takes place in the last, let's say, two races of a contest. It really is a better measure of overall handicapping, I think, when it comes to online play. Typically, I don't participate in live formats all that often. So it is kind of ironic that some of the success that we've had in online tournaments have been in the live format setting. But the pick and pray is, obviously the hardest part about it is trying to finish up all your handicapping ahead of time and then make sure that your strategy lines up. You're playing two entries, and how many times do you play two entries and they both end up at the same number? You're like, man, if I just switch one more pick and move that to the other ticket, I'd have double the amount of money on my entry one and have no money on entry two, which is what you want. Instead of, let's say, having $50 on both entries, which gets you absolutely nothing in an online tournament. So that's exactly. That's part of the game theory that's so frustrating, but also makes the game challenging and worthwhile. And you know, it's that type of thinking and processing that makes me love the sport so much. And for me, as a handicapper on these online tournaments, I'm always looking for a combination of the prices along with a couple favorites that I can use in order to kind of balance out the ticket, because obviously prizes don't win every single race, but neither do favorites in these online tournaments. And you can't win these tournaments by playing, you know, 7 or 8 favorites. I guess you can if every single one of them hits, but for the most part, that's not what happens. The game is just too random. And when you're going through and you're trying to find, you know, price sources, that's where not only just regular handicapping, but, you know, watching tape, seeing who had the trouble trips. You had a guest on earlier this week, Brian Flanders of the Trip Notes, or Trip Pro Notes, come on and talk about what he looks for and stuff. And his website right now is a great, great tool. It's still free, if I'm not mistaken, for another week, I think through June 12th. And that gives you a really good sense of, you know, the subtleties of tape watching and taking a look at bad trips and horses that are hidden, jockey intent, things of that nature, which are all things that I look for in my everyday handicapping, but also, you know, can incorporate it. It's nice to have another set of eyes to see, hey, did I miss that? Did I see that? And not that anybody should tell him, but I probably don't qualify for the NHC a couple weeks ago without his trip notes. He did help me on 1 or 2 horses.
You said something that I'd love you to talk about further, which is how has your approach changed and evolved? Because one of the challenges we hear from, you know, a lot of people that wade into the contest arena, they might have some initial success before they've even really thought about some of the strategy elements. And then the more you play, and actually this mirrors anybody's experience as a handicapper and a horse player, you know, even when you're just playing, just playing bankroll as a player, no contest involved. I've talked about this many times, about reaching a plateau and then kind of sliding back a little bit, you know, feeling like you had reached a certain level of proficiency and understanding, and then, you know, going very cold and feeling confused and sort of sliding back and then, you know, taking another forward step. That's a process I think most horse players in their, you know, evolution experience. The contest side is a slightly different animal in that you can be a very good player and a very good handicapper, and adjusting to an approach in the contest arena is demanding in a different way. And I know when I first started to, you know, to get involved, and it was John Parada actually and Johnny D that, you know, my first sort of foray at the Horse Player World Series in 2006. And I struggled with it. I mean, the way I was handicapping, and at the time I was pretty much an exacta player and a middle-priced long shot, you know, win better. And I didn't take to it. And then I found it even more troubling, Tyler. It then started to hurt my bankroll play, my you know, Monday through Sunday play. And so I said, you know what? I don't think I'm cut out for this. And so I'm curious, as somebody that, you know, kind of waded into it, you know, at a young age and it more or less, I'm sure, developed a contest approach on a parallel track to your overall, you know, evolution as a horse player, you may have come at it with fresh eyes from, you know, parallel tracks. So I'm really curious to hear how you, you know, honed your skills, both as a regular player and then as a contest player.
Well, I think first and foremost, it's still a work in progress. And sure. That it really depends on what type of contest you're playing, whether it be live money, online, pick and pray, live format. Are we talking something like the NHC where you have 3 days and a cut line? Are we talking the World Series? Are we talking the Fall Classic where it's win only as opposed to mythical win place? All of those things factor into the way that I approach a tournament. In terms of, I'll just kind of go through them one by one. When we're talking about a big tournament like the World Series or the Fall Classic or the NHC, something that is a mythical win place or win only format, you really have to be right on your opinions. And what I mean by that is you have to be right at a price. And so when I'm handicapping specifically for those tournaments, I'm looking to try to find something that's what I think a overlay or at least a fair value for what I'm trying to pick. So I'll use a cutoff of odds of, let's say, 4 or 5 to 1. Really won't play anything less than that in those types of contests. If I play anything at those 4 or 5 to 1 odds, I better be right on them, because I'm now taking away a bullet that I could be using at a much higher value that I need to hit at a far lower rate in order to vault myself up the leaderboard. The hardest thing about tournaments like that is the fact that you have to be hot and consistent for multiple days in a row. Anybody can have a good first day or a good second day. Yep. It's stringing those days together. A perfect example of something like that would be the first time I ever qualified for the NHC back in 2018. Day one started off very, very slow. Probably had $50 in mutuals, maybe 60 by the end of it. That's with 18 bets. So obviously, I was so far down the leaderboard, you couldn't even find me on it. Day two got really, really hot and was vaulted all the way up the leaderboard and had not been for a couple photos, which is the other key to every single tournament that you play. You have to win the photos when you have those price horses. It's not the photo losses at 8-5 that kill you, or 3-1. It's the cap horses, the ones that, let's say anything 15-1 to an upper cap horse that you've got to have, because you just can't make up the difference if you lose those photos. But I got all the way up into 15th place going into day three. Now, I put 1.5 days sort of together. Day three rolled around, which is where the cut line was. Need to be top 10. And I think I went 0-10 with the place. couldn't pick a winner to save my life. Ended up finishing 46th. It was a great experience. Got a check out of it. Had a ton of fun. But for the amount of time that I handicapped to put into it and the strategy that I was looking to try to do and to try to find horses at the right value, let's say, was obviously starkly varied in contrast from Friday to Saturday to Sunday. Saturday it worked. Friday it sort of worked a little bit. Sunday it sucked. And that's the challenge when you play tournaments like that are multiple days in a row. And that's when you look at, you know, the past NHC champions, and you had mentioned Scott Coles earlier, and he's actually somebody I've talked to on Twitter a couple times, and I've told him, I go, you know, you're the youngest NHC champion ever, but, you know, I've got a few more years left to come catch your mark. And what he did is just incredible, because of not only how well he handicapped for day one and day two, but when the money and the pressure was really down in day three at the final table, I think he ended up having 5 winners out of those 8 races, or 7 races.
Yes.
Which is just an unbelievable feat, and I can't stress how difficult it is, because he did it at a variety of prices. He did it from a 7-2 shot to, you know, 14-15-1 shots to get there. I mean, he almost had $100 in mutuals in those 7 races, which is really, really tough. Moving on to the other part of your question, which is kind of what you do for strategy when you're playing, you know, the online tournaments or the live money tournaments that are in, you know, single, just a one-day format. I think the biggest way that I've evolved is that I've had to really learn to be passive and pick my spots. You don't have to beat the card to win a tournament, especially when it's live money. You just have to be right on your biggest or your best opinion of the day. And then you have to make sure you hit the bet with whatever it is. You can't have a 10-1 shot. And let's say you have, like, this upcoming Sandy Derby Challenge tournament on Saturday. You have a $2,000 bankroll. You can't have your best bet of the day and you only bet $200 in it in the race, which is what the minimum denomination is for that tournament. That has to be a much larger bet, and it might not even be a win bet, because of the way that people play. You have to hit it in an exact or a double. You have to crush the race if you really are talking about winning a tournament of a caliber like that, especially with the competitors that are in there, because they're not going to be afraid to bet, and they're going to go all in at different points. And the last point would be the strategy on the online tournaments, that whether they're live format or pick and pray, it really doesn't matter. I kind of approach both tournaments the same way. I kind of treat them as pick and plays. Obviously, live formats I can adjust depending on where I am on the leaderboard, but I typically go with whatever my strongest opinions are. But in those tournaments, at certain points, you have to take the winners. You can't just pass up the money that that the race is giving you. So let's say, for instance, the NHC tournament that I qualified in. There was a filly, Tonalish Shape, trained by Joseph Saffy, who I think went off at 3-5 in the race. Obviously, 3-5 shots, playing them in any way, make me physically ill. That's just not how I play. I don't like the feeling. I'm more relieved when they win and I had them than anything else. I don't like the way they make me feel. I'm a price player. Now, I got $5.20 for the win place of that horse. I only won my spot by $4.20. I don't play Tonalish Shape. I don't win the NHC entry. Tonalish Shape is never a horse that I would ever play in either a live money tournament or a big tournament like the NHC or the World Series, something that has multiple days at that price. However, in an online tournament, single day, where everybody has to play the race, I got to take it, and I got to take the money there, make sure that I, you know, edge up my bankroll by just enough, so when I hit my key price horses, I vault me over everybody else when I'm in qualifying position.
There's so many things I could ask. When you recap afterward, and you go back and you look at your plays, and of course one of the nice innovations in recent years, both BCBC and now NHC, is, you know, the publishing of the plays, and what it invariably has shown is the variety of approaches that people have, and you know that includes changing the approach, you know, day by day, and based on, you know, the leaderboard, and when we're doing the play by play, particularly at NHC, you know, we've had that, you know, laid out in great detail, especially with the Matisses, with Paul and Duke's commentary, you know, as we have gotten toward final table and then at final table. But when you go back after any contest, what mistakes do you see? I mean, have you identified, successfully identified, you know, certain approach elements that, you know, decision-making process that has gone awry, or is it more identifying handicapping miscues, or just acknowledging that you wouldn't have done anything different?
That's a great question. I'd say probably 95% of the time when I'm going back through the tournament results and looking at my plays, it's not really the handicapping that I have any qualms with or that I'm looking to adjust. It really is the betting. And again, this portrays more to these live money tournaments, specifically the ones at San Anita. I think the best way I can articulate that is by a tournament that I played, I think it was closing day of San Anita's spring summer meet last year. That closing day, they had a tournament that was a $500 tournament, and you had $200 entry fee, $300 live money bankroll. Same tournament they had on ExpressBet last weekend. And it was like an 11 race card, and obviously when you have $300 and you're playing a tournament like that, you can't play every race. You got to pick your spots. And that's a very common theme, no matter what we're talking about, anytime it comes to live money. And I had waited all day for what I thought was my best play of the day, which was Acclimate. Well, I believe it was might have been the San Juan Capistrano, if I'm not mistaken. But he went off at, say, 8-9-1 and goes wire to wire in the race. And on the way I played the race was I put 100 to win on Acclimate. I played $100 exacta with Acclimate on top to the favorite, who ran second. And then I came back with my last $100, and I goofed around with exactas in case somebody caught Acclimate, and I split my doubles. And what I mean by splitting the doubles is I didn't go all in with Acclimate on the double. I went all in with Acclimate and the favorite in the doubles to only one of my horses in the next race. Acclimate goes wire to wire, so I cash the win bet. The favorite ran second. I hit the exacta. I vault to the top of the leaderboard. I'm like, I maybe have $4,300, which at that point, the leader was, I think, 2,000. So I probably had a $2,600, $2,700 lead with two races to go. The next race, of course, I had two horses. I only played one in the double because I took the favorite in the double as a backup in case the favorite beat me. That way my bankroll was still technically alive at that point with my thought process. My other horse wins the second leg of the double. So I don't actually hit the double, which would have got me back probably another 3,500 or so. Would have vaulted me to almost 8 grand. At that point, with a bankroll of starting bankroll of 300, you get to 8 grand. Tournament's pretty much over no matter what anybody does in the last race. I mean, you got to be pretty unlucky to get caught. But I still had the lead. I still had over 4,000 with one race to go, despite missing the double. And I was up maybe 1,500 at this point. So I took my swing in the last race, but I couldn't bet too much because I didn't want to. I want to take just enough to try to get to 7,000, figuring that was the mark to beat, but not enough to drop me so far that I would lose qualifying position, knowing that a lot of people would be gunning for the $4,000 mark to try to catch me. I ended up missing the last race. A couple people hit it. I finished fifth. And I looked back on the day of my handicapping, and everything that I had handicapped and the races I'd passed, the races I'd bet, I was real happy with. But that one minor decision on the double cost me the win. And that was a betting mistake, in my opinion, as opposed to a handicapping one. Mm-hmm. And so those are more times than not what I'm looking at when I'm going back through is how can I improve the betting? How can I make a subtle adjustment to make sure that when I have the strong opinion and I'm right on that day? Because anybody can be right on any given day. That's why you have so many different people win these tournaments. That's actually what makes it so impressive when you see the same names up on the top of the leaderboard.
Yes.
And you mentioned the brothers Duke and Paul. I mean, those guys are incredible because they're constantly at the top of these leaderboards. I mean, Paul's won the NHC, Duke's won, you know, he finished, I think, third that same year that Paul won it. They've won countless live money tournaments, online tournaments. They've been there in the Breeders' Cup. The repeated success and consistency to be up there and to make the right calls at the right times on the right value horses is what is, I think, we're all striving for. But the betting is what separates it. I don't think it's actually the handicapping. So those are what I'm reviewing, you know, after tournaments and trying to get better at every single day.
Tyler Hoffman is with us. You can follow Tyler on Twitter, Ty Hoffman, 6. And talking about his success at a young age and having been involved from the start helps. The whole family, though, right? Your dad plays and has qualified many times. And your brothers, how active are your brothers in it?
Yeah, so I'm going to go through a little bit of the family history. My parents actually met at Santa Anita back in 1981. They met in the paddock.
Oh, wow.
And so it's... The even more ironic part of their love story is that they both grew up in the Midwest. And there's no doubt that they knew each other as little kids at Arlington Park because they both played in the same playground and stuff, but they had no idea. And they both moved when they were very, very little. So it'd be really cool if there were videos to see if they had actually ever met, you know, like we all suspect they did when they were 4 and 5 years old and reconnected when they were, you know, 19 and 20. But obviously, yeah, my father is the main reason that I'm in the game. My grandfather also grew up going to the racetrack. My grandfather on my father's side, who's passed away, he was a lifelong racetracker himself. My uncles on both sides are racetrackers. And then I have two younger brothers who both enjoy the game, enjoy the sport, but they're not quite as crazy as I am. They love it, but they have other things that they also like participating in, where horse racing is my main hobby. I mean, I can get lost in a form for forever and ever and ever. There's nothing I love more than sitting down and handicapping a form for a couple hours and trying to put the puzzle together and talking strategy. And I've met so many friends through the sport, and something that's been kind of cool the last couple of years is being able to reach out and you know, introduce myself to new people and kind of get in to figure out there are people, while there's the perception that there aren't a lot of young people in racing, and that's accurate to some degree, there actually are more than people think. And some of my really, really close friends are in the sport, and, you know, they work for TVG and ExpressBet and stuff, and getting to be able to talk to them, and, you know, we share their upbringing, their stories, and go, hey, you know, that sounds a little familiar. That's kind of what mine was like, too. It's a pretty cool and a special thing to have, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
You said you went to University of Washington, and I know your dad's a builder. What are you doing work-wise?
Work-wise, we actually work together. My father started a construction company about 4 months before I was born, and never had any intention of me being in it. He didn't push it as a family business or anything like that. But it was one of those things where I was doing it for summer money between years of college and took a liking to it. And I had job opportunities in Seattle that could have kept me up there, but there's just something about Los Angeles that I absolutely love. And obviously San Diego is my playground, as is Del Mar in the summer. I wanted to come back, and he says, well, if you want to give it a shot, he goes, I'll give you a job. We'll see how it works out. And it's been about 8 years now, so I guess I'm doing okay.
Oh, that's great.
You haven't built me out yet.
That's great.
It'd be a bigger problem than a handicap, I think.
Well, and the beauty is that when the cards start, you're not going to get admonished if he catches you watching some races and being distracted for 20 minutes here, half an hour there.
Put it this way: TVG's on the office TV a lot during the especially the end of the week and on Thursdays and Fridays. And there have been several times where I've received a text while I'm in the field and says, when are you coming to the office? Because I got something we need to talk about. And I go, I'll be there in 20. And then I'll come in and he'll be like, all right, so what did you look at last night? Where are we at? And I go, I thought this was business. He goes, it is business. It's just our other business. We got to support our, business has to support our hobby as opposed to our hobby supporting our business, is the joke we like to say. So we have a lot of fun with it. And I owe my dad a lot for the way he introduced me to the game and the way he taught me and the responsibility of it. Because like I said, it's really not the gambling aspect that, while it's great to win money, that's not what drives us and what makes us love the sport. But our love for the sport really does derive from the handicapping, from the strategy that's involved, trying to put the puzzle together, trying to figure it out, trying to see, is somebody the lone speed? Is somebody going to get away? A perfect example of that is this past weekend in the Santa Maria Stakes with Fighting Mad. Again, it wasn't that we made a ton of money in the race. There's no life-changing score or anything like that. But Fighting Mad was a type of play in that five-horse field where obviously CC was the horse to beat. There's no doubt about it. She ran her eyeballs out despite having a perfect trip in the Apple Blossom. Hard Not to Love, we knew was going to take back because Smith wasn't going to let CC have an opportunity to run her down. He wanted to have something to chase. Fighting Mad was coming off an obvious prep in the Desert Stormer, which meant if Hard Not to Love takes back, Fighting Mad gets a lonely lead. And if we're assuming CeCe's going to bounce, that means Fighting Mad's going to, be out there by two or three lengths, and it's definitely going to be the one to run down. And 10-1 on a five-horse field is just crazy. And that type of puzzle and seeing that thing come together and watching that race as it developed, and, we were texting each other actually during the race because we weren't together, and going, this is too good to be true. It can't be this easy. And watching somebody, watching Fighting Mad, run down the lane, clear of everybody else and stuff, that's the type of joy that we get from the handicapping aspect that makes the sport so special and so much fun.
Flesh out your handicapping approach, and obviously, the pace side of things. You referenced, the trip angles, and I'm sure a lot of replay watching, but. We had that fun conversation with Ryan a couple days ago that kind of fleshed out his concept, tripnotepros.com. But other areas, what PPs do you like to use? Any other added information, premium speed figures, clocker notes? What else goes into your equation making?
No, it's really just handicapping the PPs. I'm a BrisNet player. And the reason for that is just it's what I grew up on. It's what we've always looked at. Obviously, a lot of tape watching. We try to specialize in certain races. So for us, we like the cheap claiming sprints, especially for colts and geldings. That's kind of more of our forte. I take grass racing after that. So we tend to focus on those types of races and look at it a lot closer than we would others. So take, for instance, like a five-horse field stakes race, which is kind of an ironic example to give a few minutes ago, isn't really what gets the juices flowing. It's the $10,000, $10,000 claimers that are full fields that you're trying to pick out the speed, who's coming to a race, who's a form cycle, things like that. We're looking for equipment changes. Who has excuses? Who can we say? Okay, and Ryan's really, really good at this, where he says, on his trip notes, he'll say, draw a line through this, or the race is a complete toss. And that's essentially the same formula that I was taught at a very young age, is horse racing is all about excuse handicapping. can we eliminate the poor performances to explain why there was a good performance and why that good performance can be repeated today at the value that we want? And so that's where, you know, we focus on a lot of our handicapping. And the joke I'll never forget, I was probably 7 or 8 years old, and I was really excited for, I don't remember what stakes card it was. It was something at Del Mar. It could have been Pacific Classic Day. And I'm going back and forth, and Dad, you know, I like this horse, and, you know, what about this horse and stuff? And there were, I mean, 7-2, 3-1 shots, whatnot. But they were tough stakes races. And his best bet of the day was in a cheap claimer. It was like the only one on the card. And he goes, son, he goes, that 10-1 shot, pays $22, $23. It pays the exact same in a claiming 10,000 as it does in a grade one race. It really doesn't matter which one it is. You just got to hit it.
Yeah.
So it goes back to, wanted to get another old family joke with this, you know, find your, you know, keep the best of company and find your horses in the worst. That's kind of the attitude that we take with the with horse racing. Is we're just looking for value, and we know what we're good at, and we know what we like to go after, and that's really what we're looking at.
You know, it's funny that you identify the lower level value claiming races, because for a long time, I mean, personally, I would make them harder than they needed to be, and it was Brad Free. Brad Free, several years ago, kind of cured me of that concern about being overly worried about the form of cheap claimers. And in fact, Brad takes the opposite tact, which is that they're more formful in a lot of cases, and that you can be confident of their form, as opposed to, you know, finding it suspect and erratic. And that I can think of two incidents, in fact, of being cured of either misconceptions or, you know, talking myself personally into being intimidated by a kind of race. And the other one along these lines was down the hill at Santa Anita. And Rick Hammerly cured me of that. Hammer told me, you know, don't be intimidated and don't be confused. This is the kind of horse that succeeds down the hill. And it in very short order, it became, I won't say that the cheap claiming events are my favorite, but I will say that the hill races became, along with 7/8 on the main, anywhere, my favorite races to approach and to fire in. I came to love the, you know, the hill course, and that's why I can't wait till it gets back. But I mean, longest time, it would flummox me in particularly in multi-race wager schemes where, you know, there'd be a hill race and I would use too many horses or overthink it or not understand, you know, who was best suited for the assignment. And you know, once I got, you know, put on the, you know, the right path, it, in both of these arenas, it solved a lot of, you know, challenge, you know, mentally to pick the right horse and to bet with confidence.
Yeah, no, I mean that's really the tricky part of handicapping is trying to figure out what angles work at what distances and what levels, because there is a formula and a pattern to everything. I mean, that's essentially what handicapping is. You're trying to find patterns, and when you're talking about those 7/8 races or the 6.5 down the hills, I mean, a great angle on both of those are speeds on cutbacks. Any horse that's turning back in distance that has natural speed at a route, because they have the stamina to get there, that the sprinters that are stretching out from, let's say, 5.5 or 6 to get the extra half a furlong or furlong, you know, they get a little bit leg weary late. And they have the horses on the turn back have the ability where they have the stamina to get there to finish the race, but they also have the natural distance speed to stay within, you know, the area code of the true speed horses. And that's part of the, I mean, I can't tell you how much fun I've had with, on that particular angle, specifically those two races. And that's why it's, you know, it's been so tough not to have the down the hill races anymore. And hopefully they're coming back. I'm hearing good things in the background, and I'm optimistic, especially with the leadership of Aiden Butler and Nate Newby at Santa Anita. I think we're trending in the positive direction, on the West Coast, and Santa Anita's taking a lot of heat over the past, we'll say, year and a half, and some of it deservedly so, but a lot of it not deserved at all. And I think I have a hunch that we'll see the 6.5 down the hill races return, hopefully by the start of the 2020-2021 winter meet.
Well, let's get it done. We had heard the same kind of rumblings and hopeful that it happens sooner than later. How aggressive will you be trying to get a second seat?
I probably won't be that aggressive. It's actually kind of ironic because I've been double qualified the last 2 years. It just kind of worked out that way. The NHC is one of those things where the more you chase it, unless you're playing for the tour, there's a saying that a lot of people on the tour say that you don't choose the tour chooses you. And that's very true when I think it comes to qualifying. There are going to be a lot of qualifiers, I have a feeling, by the end of the year. You'll see a lot more super qualifiers, which right now online you have I can't remember what the ratio is, it's one per a lot of people. And so it's very, very tough to qualify. But in these super qualifiers, you'll see where they'll have online tournaments that'll be 1 per 10 or 1 per 15. And when those start rolling around, that's probably where I'll take a couple of chances to see if I can get that second entry. But at a tournament like the NHC, while it's great to have it, a lot of times having the second entry screws you up. I mean, I finished 46th, and I was in 15th place after D2 with one entry. I've had two entries the last 2 years, and I couldn't be any further from it. All I've done is split my entries. So maybe it's better to just have one. It's the ultimate, as much fun as the NHC tournament is, you have to be so incredibly lucky when you're competing against, 600-plus entries. And you never know when it's going to be your day and when you're going to get hot and when everything's going to line up. So right now I'd say more of my contest focus is going to be trying to win a Breeders' Cup seat and then ultimately maybe a Pegasus seat. So I'll start dabbling a little bit more on the online qualifying for those. But for right now, just enjoying the fact that we have racing going on in Southern California again. That's been a real bright spot. I'm looking forward to a nice weekend of racing there with all those stakes races.
Tyler Hoffman has been with us, and before we wrap up and mentioning some of the options coming up this weekend, and you referenced the Santa Anita Derby Day Challenge online at ExpressBet, two seats on Saturday. We'll see what that lineup entails, and also at Horse Players, three seats, the next free contest. There was one earlier in the year, three seats in the free contest, and it's a free roll for everybody. You do have to be members of the tour. You got to sign up. It's $50 and well worth it. So don't make that mistake. But Saturday at Horse Players. And there's also actually at Horse Players on Friday two seats, just a nice Friday afternoon, and there's very good racing tomorrow, Belmont and Santa Anita. And
it'll be dry at both locations.
Yeah, very much. And it's going to be, right now, the weather's nice and free and clear, at least in the Northeast. There's also a horse tourneys, there's no tour points in this unless they get 42, and I've got to get more detail. That's on Sunday. I don't have the details on that. And as I mentioned earlier this morning, the first in-person contest is going to be at Lone Star on the 27th. And we'll talk to Brandon Lee maybe next week and get, I'm sure he's in the planning stages. And at NYRA, they're also in the planning stages. We should have details early next week about the Belmont Day contest as well. So it's been all online, and even some of the typically locale games have been transferred online, and everybody doing what they can to keep this ball in the air. And Tyler, for you, very welcome scenario as you get your first seat for next year in Vegas, and we assume we're still at Bally's. That's a problem for Keith Shamblin and the team, but to figure out. I think we're going to be okay, but from what we understand, Bally's is going to be, Rich Eng is going to join us momentarily. Bally's apparently is going to be the last Caesars property in Vegas to reopen. So I don't know what that, you know, I don't know what the scenario is there. But Tyler, I'm delighted for your ongoing success, and I probably won't see you maybe until the winter next year, either at Santa Anita or at Vegas. But congratulations and continued success.
Thank you so much. This was a ton of fun for me. Thank you so much for having me.
Not at all. And I just hope that, you know, it just shows for everybody that, you know, wants to get involved, you just have to try. And there's going to be a learning curve. There's going to be some trial and error. But, you know, look at how Tyler has advanced to, you know, this point where now 5 years running of qualification. You know, we talked to Nick Tamaro on a regular basis, and you know, he introduced Jonathan Kinchin to, you know, the contest arena. I mean, you get started, you're going to find your way, and it's, you know, tremendous fun. Rich Eng, who's joining us, can tell you too. I mean, Rich was involved in the contest world, you know, before it became a thing. Really, I mean, it was sort of a hidden secret in certain quarters and in certain, you know, horse playing arenas. And you know, that development, you mentioned, you just heard Tyler talk about that Reno contest. Rich has mentioned it before. The Penn National, you know, they helped get the contest side of things started. But Tyler Hoffman, a real pleasure. You can follow Ty on Twitter, TyHoffman6, and look forward to meeting them. I think we have met, if I'm not mistaken. But dad's Alan, right? Alan Hoffman. I think we've met, but you know, I'm on the other side of midnight, it seems, more and more. Rich Eng, good morning. Yep. I thought I heard Rich back there. No? Case? Yeah. Is he there? Rich. Actually, Case, pick him up, because it's dead. At first I heard that little noise that says somebody's there, and then it's gone. Huh. Yeah, I can hear Case. Yeah, I can hear Casey talking to Rich. We'll get Rich on. So again, for the weekend, first NHC contest at Express Bet, the Santa Anita Derby Challenge, and the Saturday 3-seat free contest. And also, you know, the feeders, those private feeders that have been an instant success. They're, you know, they've really been a nice addition, a clever, you know, a clever wrinkle that we talked to Keith Shamblin about when Michelle Ravencraft and Holly Short. They, you know, you get in touch with Michelle if you want to have a private feeder. Let's try Rich again. Rich Eng, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
There he is. Rich, I don't know how much of what you might have heard just before. Tyler Hoffman, who's 30-ish, five-time qualifier at NHC, and you know, he talked about his evolution as a player, and I referenced you as, you know, one of the early people to recognize the potential of contest play.
Oh, well, thank you for that, and congratulations to Tyler to qualify five times is a tremendous achievement, and, you know, to qualify once is difficult enough, but to do it again and again and again and again, that's fabulous work on his part. And you know, the thing about trying to win the big prize when you come out here to Vegas is you've got to be among the 600 or 700 or 800 people to actually get there to the final table, and then to move on to the top prize to grab the brass ring. So you got the only chance you got is you got to get here. And congratulations to him again.
Oh, that's one of those, you know, got to be in it to win it scenarios.
Yep.
You know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key. But, you know, he referenced something, and I actually lauded him on that front. I see his name on a regular basis when looking at the, you know, particularly at the Santa Anita-based contests. And you see the same names, including, you know, a lot of your pals. Ken Jordan has been on an Kenny's been on a extended success run, and Lou Peloso, and mm-hmm. you know, the whole team. I mean, there's certain people that John Nichols had during the pandemic. John was, you know, free to tee off, and my God, he he got his qualifications in. He won a, you know, he won cash. He just missed a BCBC punch. Now he's of course with the Churchill up and running, and a little bit, you know, he's a little bit more focused on the work side. But guys get on rolls. It's amazing. And you just, you know, you see them on a regular basis.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And, you know, my opportunity to learn more about this, Steve, is the opportunity to actually sit next to and with Kenny Jordan when he's been playing in these tournaments. And, I must admit, I catch myself looking over my shoulder because I look at his notes and I see the type of things that he's looking for as far as handicapping. And he doesn't use just one tool out there. You know, for folks who are fairly new to tournament play, there's no one set way to get there. It's not one of those my way or the highway type of deals. There are different methods, different systems, different styles, and watching Kenny in operation, I have just learned so much how he utilizes the different tools that are available to not just Kenny, but all handicappers, and piecing things together. And, you know, one thing that is a common reference for all of us who handicap and play the horses on a daily basis, Steve, I know, I want to congratulate you for, I saw the other day you put out a tremendously successful play on your website that came in and paid a few thousand dollars, and I congratulate you and all the listeners who followed that. But to actually find live long shots, you know, sometimes they look quite ugly on the racing form and the past performances, but there are things embedded within that animal's past performances that lead people to think, hey, this horse has a shot at, you know, 20-1, 30-1, 40-1, whatever. So it's a great learning experience for me, too, to watch other people in action.
Well, thanks for that, Rich. And you know, one of the, I mean, if we use that as an example, one of the benefits that these large fields that it's affording is horses that are getting lost on the board. And you know, when you have particularly over 10, over, you know, an eight horse field, it seems to be enough to, you know, for things to be productive. But when you start to get to 10, 11, 12, and particularly 12, 13, 14 horses, there is just, it's impossible almost not to find plays, because there's just too many. And the public invariably is going to be lured in to, you know, I don't want to say the obvious, but the likely. And all you have to do is be cognizant and be open to horses that aren't going to be the first, second, or third choice. Once you start to get to that fourth, fifth, sixth choice, you're putting yourself in a position to cash big tickets. Because there's a chance that a horse like a Secret Message the other day is going to be, you know, when you handicap, I talked about making your own line, and when you handicap, and okay, a horse like that, you know, she's probably the fifth or sixth most likely winner. Then when she just, you know, floats up and is just, you know, twice the price she should have been, then you're laughing. I mean, that's when you cash four digit and five digit type caches.
Mm-hmm. You know, Steve, I remember a story. I wish I knew, I could remember the details better, but it was easily 12 or 15 years ago, but I read a story about a woman who did very well in a handicapping tournament, and she didn't handicap at all. But what she did was, this was what she told the reporter, the writer, was that she had the overnight from the different tracks that were in the tournament, and she relied upon the morning line that was put on these overnights to be somewhat accurate and, you know, thoughtful. And what she was doing was she would look at a horse, and she was looking for horses that were going off at much higher odds than their morning line. An extremely simplistic approach. And, you know, maybe some people would think about it derisively that, you know, it's just throwing a dart at at the overnight. But in reality, if the morning line maker actually has an idea of what he's doing, and there are definitely good morning line makers out there. If you don't make your own morning line, it's all you have to go with. But she was trying to find horses that were going off at much higher odds than the morning line, and bingo, she was nailed a whole bunch of them and did very well in the tournament. So that was just a simplistic way of explaining looking for overlays. But, you know, what you talked about, were making your own morning line. That's something that professionals like to do, and it's extremely helpful. And if your opinion is different than the morning line, and you have found a huge edge, because you'll be led to an animal that is just being overlooked by the public.
Exactly. Well, Rich, we got about 4 minutes, 3-4 minutes to find a couple of horses for today. And I don't know if you looked at Churchill. I want to remind people that the eighth race at Churchill today, you got Guarana coming back for Chad Brown and 3-5. But just exciting to get her back in action. And then there's, you know, the Tiller with Sadler's Joy at Belmont as the ninth. You've got that 3-year-old allowance we've been talking about. Rich, what are you looking at today?
Well, I tell you what, going back to Chad Brown, if he was a blue chip stock, he would definitely be a buy, even at if he cost a lot per unit, because he is going to get ready to explode. He's been sitting on these horses all the winter and spring, and they are ready to run out of their skin. So he's gonna be dynamite wherever he shows up. Let me just give a couple of horses at Churchill. Let's go to the second race. It's a mile and a 16th, claiming 20,000 non-winners of two lifetime. But let's try the 3-horse, Lord Dragon. Miguel Mena riding for Jordan Blair, but this horse, third race off a long layoff, was bet down to 2-1 last time at Tampa Bay Downs, and quite frankly disappointed, but should be a much better price here. And a lot of the Tampa horses run well when they leave there. I say the same for a lot of the Oakland horses, and I'll be giving an Oakland horse next. But let's try the 3, Lord Dragon, in the second race at Churchill Downs. And let me go down a little further here, Steve. I'm scrolling my I didn't actually have a chance to print the racing form, so I've been looking it off the digital version.
Sure.
Let's go to race number 7, and we'll give out a horse that's 10-1 in the morning line. I know that's the kind of prize you love. Let's go with number 6, Dak Janiels. This horse ran very well, finally breaking through with a big effort at the Oaklawn Park last time for Jack Sisterson. Declan Cannon is the jockey. But this race is really full of contention, and this horse either is going to be on the lead or very close to the lead. And like I say, coming out of Oaklawn Park, I've been following that form, and in the right situation, those horses are very dangerous. And 10-1 is the score price for me. Number 6, Dak Janiels in the 7.
Well, and Dak Janiels is an interesting play, because there, you look at that race that he ran on the turf. He had the one star, right? Yeah, the one. They several times, Sisterson, Kieran tried to get him on the grass, and then he ran an okay race in that maiden 30. And people are going to look at this and say, he might not be, he's not really a turf horse. He's okay. He's out of a Smart Strike mare, and any step forward would be... is going to make him competitive. Scabbard goes to the grass here, as I'm sure Eddie Keneally has gotten very frustrated with Scabbard. And so being a more than ready And he is a gelding, so there's plenty of time. In fact, I think this is first time gelding for Scabbard. Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Sutton and Eddie have decided let's at least try to have a productive career with him, even if he's not going to be a 3-year-old stake horse. That's a good race. There's a lot of good races today, both Churchill and at Belmont. You got 2-year-olds at Churchill in the fourth as well. For those of you that took advantage of Nick Tamaro's analysis for the whole card, it's up at the website. And Nick, with a terrific start yesterday, pretty much had winners all over the place. Five top choice winners and 3 second choice winners. And I'm gonna sit back and wait for tomorrow, and I'll do the Belmont late action myself tomorrow. Rich Eng, everybody, Rich Eng for Pro Pick on Twitter and RaceDateLasVegas.com, especially for this weekend's action. Get Rich's analysis for the big Santa Anita Derby card on Saturday. Rich, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. And as I sign out, the open for business shingle is up here in Las Vegas. Casinos open, some of them at 12:01, some of them at 6, some of them at 8, some of them at 10. But the thing is, we're back in action, and I hear the crowds are very, very large in these casinos here in Vegas.
Amazing. Amazing. Rich Eng, everybody, and we'll get more on that next week. Going to send you out into the race day. Good luck. I want to thank Dick Powell, John Parada, Tony Black, Tyler Hoffman, and Rich. And we'll send you out with one of the most moving protest songs of any era, civil rights and beyond. Here's Billie Holiday, Jan Mirapol's Strange Fruit.
Blood on the leaves and blood at the road. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree. Gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter cry.
The Lake. At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California, Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. Bleeding all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Here in Pennsylvania, we have the best breeding program in the country, thanks in part to our Racehorse Development Trust Fund. It's a trust, it's not tax dollars, and by law, our fund is completely protected. These are difficult days for all of us. When life in America gets back to normal, and it will, our PA breeding program will be here, stronger and better than ever. To learn more about how we're protecting the trust, go to PABred.com to watch a short video.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.